Hey, American Hauntings listeners, it's Troy. Need more American Hauntings in your life? You know you do. So why not check out our other podcast, The Alternate Show, that we do for our Patreon supporters only. Comes out every other week, opposite this one, which means you get our special kind of murder, mystery, mayhem, and the macabre every single week. Right now, we're almost at the end of our latest season, Sinister, the true story of H.H. Holmes, a deep dive into the twisting and turning story of the infamous serial killer linked to the 1893 World's Fair in Chicago. So check that out, get that new episode every week, and be a part of American Hauntings by becoming a Patreon supporter and subscribing at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And now, on with the show. The shrill sound of a ringing telephone jolted Jeannie Sauter from her sleep. As she stirred in her bed, she was confused at first about the sound and where it was coming from. Her husband, George, slept soundly beside her. Across the room in a small bed, her youngest child, Sylvia, snored peacefully. Jeannie's head cleared, and she realized it was the telephone in her husband's office at the other end of the house. Not wanting the clanging sound to wake up everyone else, Jeannie quickly got out of bed and hurried to the office. Her knee bumped hard into the desk as she reached for the receiver. "Hello," she spoke into the handset. From the earpiece, Jeannie could hear music and several voices, as if someone was calling from a party. There was some rustling on the other end of the line, as if the caller was having trouble holding on to the receiver. And then a woman's voice spoke, asking for a man that Jeannie didn't know. "I'm sorry," Jeannie replied. "There's no one here by that name. I'm afraid you have the wrong number." The woman on the other end of the line laughed. Jeannie later said that her tone was very strange. It was a laugh that would haunt her for many years to come. Then the line went dead, and Jeannie hung up the telephone. Jeannie closed the office door behind her and walked back toward her bedroom. As she crossed the living room, she saw her 17-year-old daughter, Marion, asleep on the couch. The family had celebrated Christmas a little early with presents that Marion had brought home from work. The living room had been left in a chaotic state. The window shades had not been drawn, and the front door had been left unlocked when everyone had gone to bed. Well, Jeannie quietly turned the lock on the door, pulled down the shades, and pulled Marion's blanket up to her chin. It was chilly in the house that night. Minutes later, Jeannie was back in bed. Soon she dozed off the unusual telephone call, mostly forgotten. Later, she would have no idea about how long she'd been asleep when she was awakened again. Her sleep was broken by a loud thump, followed by what sounded like a ball rolling across the roof and off the side of the house. Whatever it was, she heard it thump on the ground. Years later, the driver of a passing bus reported that he had seen, quote, balls of fire being tossed on the roof of the Sauter house that morning. Jeannie thought about waking George, but decided to go back to sleep. But she woke once again a short time later. It wasn't a sound that awakened her this time, though. It was the smell of smoke. She sprang out of bed and ran into the hallway to try and get to the office telephone, but she saw flames were already burning in that part of the house. The path to the telephone was blocked. She screamed for her husband and ran to wake Marion, who was still sleeping on the couch. She told her to get Sylvia from the bedroom and go out the front door and wait. Jeannie pushed past her and shouted up the stairs for the rest of the children. By now, George was awake and struggling to get into his clothes. He ran outside to the water barrel that stood near the house. John and George Jr., the two oldest Sauter boys at home, appeared at the top of the stairs and ran down. The fire was roaring along the wall, and both received minor burns as they fled from the flames. John had shouted for his younger siblings, or he had gone into the bedrooms to awaken them, according to one of his statements to the police, and thought he'd heard them respond. The boys fled outside, where Marion, Sylvia, George, and Jeannie were shivering in the cold. Realizing that the rest of the children were still inside, George tried desperately to get them out of the house, but the front rooms and the staircase were now engulfed in flames. The water barrel had been frozen solid, so George used it as a step to try and climb up the side of the house. but he quickly fell. So he smashed a window, badly slicing his hand and his arm, but the fire was too hot, preventing him from getting inside. George frantically called toward the upper floor of the house, pleading with his children to come to the window. He then remembered the ladder that he kept at the side of the house and ran to where it should have been. But it was gone. Panicked, he came up with another idea. He would drive one of his trucks up to the house and then climb on top of the cab so he could reach the upper windows. He ran to the nearest truck, climbed into the cab, and cranked the engine. It wouldn't start. He jumped down and ran to his other truck. He tried to start this one too, but the motor wouldn't turn over. Both trucks had worked perfectly the day before. While George was struggling with the trucks, Marion had handed Sylvia to her mother and run to a neighbor's house to call the fire department. She pounded on the door until a light appeared in the window. She quickly explained what was happening and begged to use the telephone. The front door quickly opened and the young woman rushed inside. Mary clicked the receiver, but no operator answered to put the call through. It was a shared party line, and no one was on duty during the early morning hours of Christmas Day. Around 1 a.m., another neighbor spotted the fire and ran to a local tavern to call for help. He was also unable to get an operator on the line, so he drove 2 miles into Fayetteville, West Virginia, to wake up the fire chief, F.J. Morris. And then came the next delay. Morris had to find firefighters to help with the blaze because he was unable to drive the fire truck. At the Sauter home, the fire continued to burn unchecked, while the family and a scattering of friends and neighbors crowded around. Later, everyone who was there that morning agreed that they never saw a child's face in an upstairs window, and they never heard a cry for help. The house burned. The onlookers saw the lights in the house go out and saw the Christmas tree lights in the window flicker and then go dark. It took only 30 minutes for the Sauter house to be turned into a pile of smoldering brick and wood. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the final episode of our current season, Gone, which is hosted and produced by Cody Beck and written and performed by Troy Taylor. That's me. You already know what we've done this season. We've opened the files of the missing and the lost and introduced you to a collection of mysterious stories in which the central character is simply gone, never to return. This is the last episode of the season, episode 24. And we'll leave you with a holiday mystery from 1945 that has never been solved. Of all the stories that we featured during this season of the podcast, this one may be one of the strangest. It's a story of holiday heartbreak and tragedy and of 5 children who went missing from their West Virginia home on a cold December night. Or is it? The only thing we know for sure about the night of December 25th, 1945 is that a mysterious fire broke out in the home of George and Jeannie Sauter and burned the house to the ground. 5 of their children had been in the house before the fire began, and yet somehow their remains weren't found in the ruins of the house once the blaze was finally put out. The authorities insisted that the children had died, and yet somehow all 5 children were later spotted in various places, creating a baffling and complex real-life mystery that's become more mysterious than anything that could be found in fiction. What happened to the Sauter children? Did they die in the fire, or were they kidnapped that night for reasons that have never been explained? And if they were, why has no trace of them ever been found? It was the holiday season for the folks who lived in the country near Fayetteville, West Virginia. A light snow had fallen, making it a white Christmas, and all seemed right with the world. George Sauter Sr. and his wife Jeannie were the proud parents of 10 children and lived in a newly built home just outside of town. George, a 50-year-old Italian immigrant, had recently started the Dempsey Transfer Company, a coal trucking firm that he ran from an office in his home. It was already prospering. He owned 2 trucks, and 2 of his sons worked for him. Another Sauter son, Joe, was in the army, but because World War II had ended several months earlier, he was out of danger. The rest of the children were at home with their parents, celebrating the season with gifts, food, and family. Life was good for the Sauters, and the new year promised to be even better. As was their tradition, the Sauter children opened their presents on Christmas Eve. Among the gifts for the younger children were toys that had been purchased by Marion from her job at a dime store in Fayetteville. George went to bed early that night, and so did the older boys, John, who was 23, and George Jr., who was 16. They both worked for their father in the coal hauling business. The other children, Maurice, 14, Martha, 12, Louis, 10, Jenny, 8, and Betty, 6, all said they were too excited to sleep, but finally went to bed around 10 p.m. The upper floor of the Sauter house was divided into two large rooms, one for the boys and the other for the girls. Jeannie went to bed soon after the children did, taking 2-year-old Sylvia into the bedroom she shared with her husband. She was looking forward to a good night's sleep before the holiday festivities of the next day. But Jeannie didn't get a good night's sleep. Not that night, or for any night, for the rest of her life. Jeannie was roused from her sleep 3 times, by the ringing telephone, the unusual sound on the roof, and finally, by the fire. In the confusion, half of the family made it out of the house, but 5 of the children sleeping upstairs never came out. George tried to get into the burning house, but the stairs were engulfed in flames. He searched for the ladder to reach the upper floor, but it had vanished. The Sauters later found it 75 feet from the house, where it had been tossed down an embankment. The coal trucks, each of which had run perfectly on Christmas Eve, refused to start. Attempts to call the fire department failed, but eventually Fayetteville Fire Chief F.J. Morris was tracked down. But even after that, the fire department didn't arrive into their home until 8 a.m., 7 hours after the blaze began. The delay was explained by the department's lack of manpower caused by the war and by the chief's inability to drive Fayetteville's fire truck. Chief Morris had to wait until he could find a qualified driver, and Fayetteville didn't have a fire alarm in 1945, so they had to rely on a phone tree. An operator would call one firefighter, then another. But with no operators apparently on duty, the calls took hours to complete. You couldn't direct dial in rural areas back then. An operator was required to connect calls manually, and since it was Christmas, everyone had the night off. By the time firefighters did arrive, the Sauter home had been reduced to a crumble of ruins over a smoking, ash-filled basement. There was little for the firefighters to do other than to hose down the few smoldering embers that remained in the debris. A brief search of the ruins ended at 10 a.m. on Christmas Day, with Chief Morris telling the Sauters that no trace of the children could be found. He suggested the fire had been hot enough to cremate their remains completely, and suggested that they keep some of the ashes to create a memorial for the lost children. It was the only helpful suggestion he made that day, and the Sauters weren't interested in hearing it. The fire department and the police officials left, saying they would return for a more thorough investigation of the site. Well, later that day, Jeannie, Marion, and Sylvia, who'd been staying with Jeannie's sister, returned home, and the family set up a makeshift apartment in an outbuilding on the farm. The Red Cross and members of the local Board of Education visited them, offering food and any assistance the Sauters needed. Meanwhile, the official investigation was just getting started. A quick coroner's inquest was held, and the 6-man jury took little time to decide that the fire was caused by faulty wiring. A report from the state police agreed. House State Trooper F.E. Springer, who wrote the report, or the coroner's jury for that matter, came to this conclusion is unknown, since there was absolutely no evidence found to say there was anything wrong with the wiring in their brand new home. The state police report also stated it was their belief that the fall of the house's 2 chimneys would have had enough heat and weight to destroy any bodies inside. Well, this would be the first of many explanations about why no human remains were found after the fire. There would also be rumors spread that George had stored significant quantities of oil and gasoline in the basement, something that George would always deny, and again, there was no evidence of. But even if he had done this, it still wouldn't explain the missing bodies. What we know today that wasn't known in 1945 is that the fire, which leveled the Sauter home in about half an hour, never reached the temperature required for the total cremation of human remains. That would have taken 2 to 3 hours and would have required a temperature of 1,400 to 1,800 degrees. In fact, various household appliances found in the burned-out basement were still recognizable. They wouldn't have been if the temperatures had reached the necessary levels for cremation. But George and Jeannie didn't have that information. They were heartbroken, believing the jury's verdict that their 5 children had died in the fire. George couldn't stand to look out the window of the outbuilding where they were living and see the hole where his house used to be and where he believed the ashes of his children remained. So on December 29th, he obtained a bulldozer and covered the basement with 5 feet of dirt, explaining that he planned to plant flowers and preserve the site as a memorial for the children. On December 30th, death certificates were issued for the 5 children. As far as the authorities were concerned, the case was now officially closed. But was it really? Well, that's the real question here, because there were strange things happening to the Sauter family before and after the fire that make even the most skeptical among us take notice. There was something very unusual happening, but what it may have been, no one can or is willing to say. The weird events began in late 1945. Jeannie and some of the children had noticed a strange man parked on the road near the house every day around the time that the children returned home from school. He didn't get out of his car or approach the children in any way. He simply sat and watched them walking home. Well, Jeannie started to get a little concerned, but before she could confront him, he was gone and he didn't return. Another day, a man approached George in the yard asking about possible work around the farm or with George's trucking company. George didn't have anything to offer the man, but as the stranger was turning to leave, he pointed out a new exterior fuse box that had been recently upgraded for an electric oven the family had installed. He warned George that the new fuse box could, quote, cause a fire someday. In October 1945, George turned down an insurance policy that had been offered to him by a local salesman. Well, the man flew into a rage and warned him that his house would, quote, go up in smoke, and his children would be killed thanks to dirty remarks that George had made about Benito Mussolini, Italy's fascist dictator who'd been killed in April of 1945. Like most of the immigrants who fled Italy after the rise of the fascist government before the war, George certainly disliked Mussolini and probably had some disparaging things to say about him. Well, apparently the insurance man didn't share his opinions. But interestingly, that same insurance salesman was a member of the coroner's jury that decided that the fire at the Sauter house was accidental. A newspaper report also stated that just before the holiday season, a woman and 3 men had shown up at the Sauter house and asked Jeannie if they could, quote, see their babies. The newspaper didn't make a note of Jeannie's reaction, but I'm willing to guess she closed the door in their faces. Then on the night of the fire, while the house was still burning, a man was spotted breaking into the Sauter's garage and stealing an auto block and tackle. The man, identified in the newspapers as Johnson, was later tracked down and arrested. Strangely, though, he was never investigated for any possible involvement with the fire itself. When a telephone repairman came to the Sauter home site to install service to the outbuilding where the family was living, he told them that the original telephone line that had been running to the house hadn't failed because of the fire, and it hadn't burned through. He said it had been cut at a point that was 14 feet off the ground and 2 feet from the utility pole. This meant that it had been cut between the time of the Laughing Lady's call on Christmas Eve and the start of the fire. Later, Johnson, the burglar who stole the auto equipment, confessed that he had cut the telephone wire, allegedly mistaking it for the electrical line. To do it, though, he would have needed a ladder to make the cut, which might explain why the solder's ladder was not found in its usual spot next to the house. But why would he cut the electrical line to the house so he could steal tools from the garage? Well, this makes no sense unless he, or someone else, wanted the lights to be out in the house for some reason. What Johnson was really doing that night is just another of the unanswered questions in the case, and there turned out to be a lot more. The inquest verdict that the fire had started because of a faulty wiring made George and Jeannie question the things they'd seen on Christmas morning. Based on the jury's findings, the electricity in the house should have gone out immediately. But the Sodders, as well as their neighbors, remembered the lights being on while the house was burning. They'd seen the Christmas lights in the window, and they were on long after the blaze had started. They had serious doubts about the official version of events, but before they could go to the authorities, they decided to do some investigating on their own. Jeannie put chicken and pig bones in a metal container and set the whole thing on fire. After burning for a few minutes, the fire went out, leaving scorched but intact bones behind. She also read a newspaper article about a nearby house fire. The house had also burned completely to the ground. Seven people had been trapped inside, and after the fire, all seven bodies were easily identifiable. The Sodders also learned about the late-night bus driver who reported seeing unknown persons throwing balls of fire onto the roof of their house. In March of 1946, Sylvia Sodder found a green, hard rubber object near the ruins, which some believed was some sort of fire bomb. The Sodders later claimed that the house had burned from the roof downward rather than from the ground floor up, but no evidence remained to prove their story. However, the idea of fire bombs being thrown onto the roof might explain the strange noises that Jeannie heard when she was awakened a short time before the fire started. George and Jeannie had now started to believe that the children had somehow been removed from their house before the fire. But how? If the children had seen a stranger, surely they would have called out. How could kidnappers have not disturbed John and George Jr., who shared a room with two of the missing children? And how could strangers have gotten the children out of the house without anyone noticing? Well, despite these questions, they took their suspicions to the authorities, who had no interest in reopening the case. The Sodders were told they needed to accept the jury's findings of death by accident. It was a tragedy, they were told, but their children were dead and they needed to move on. But George and Jeannie weren't going to just move on. They refused to go along with the official conclusion and hired two detectives, C.C. Tensley and George Swain, to conduct an investigation of their own. The detectives went to work, not only trying to run down information about the children, but also trying to discover if someone had hard feelings against the Sodders. Possible enemies might have caused the fire or kidnapped the children, but who hated them enough to do those things? Well, things would soon become even more confusing and convoluted. But before that, the sightings began. The first came from the manager of a motel that was located halfway between Fayetteville and Charleston, West Virginia. He claimed that he saw the five Sodder children there on Christmas Day. A resident of Charleston later said that he saw four of the children, Martha, Lewis, Jenny, and Betty, with four unknown adults about 1 week after the fire. The adults spoke Italian, and they were never identified. And there'd be more to come. In 1947, a church minister from Fayetteville named James F. Frame told the Sodders a strange story. While Fire Chief Morris had stated that no remains were found at the fire scene in 1945, Morris privately claimed to have found a heart in the ashes, which he placed in an empty dynamite box and buried at the scene without reporting the discovery. The clergyman said that Morris did it in secret because he didn't want to make the Sodder family more upset. He said that he'd hoped they would find the organ in the ruins of the house and call off their private investigation. Well, George and Jeannie eventually persuaded Chief Morris to show them where he'd buried the box. They dug up the box, took it straight to the funeral home, and asked the director to open the box and examine it. When he opened it, he found what looked like a decayed beef liver inside. It was untouched by the fire, meaning it had been placed there after the blaze. Well, a few days later, Detective Cece Tansley went to the funeral home to retrieve the liver and get an official statement about the mystery organ, but it had disappeared. The undertaker said that since they didn't have cold storage equipment on the premises, he'd just left the liver sitting on the back porch until Tinsley could get there to claim it. And he shrugged and suggested maybe somebody had thrown it out with the trash. Okay, so what is going on with the buried liver? Chief Morris's actions make no sense. If he'd wanted the Sodders to find the liver and put their minds at rest, as he claimed, how did he think they would find it locked in a box and buried under several feet of dirt? And wouldn't the fact that it was in a box indicate that someone had purposely placed it there? Even the fire marshal stated that there was no clear reason for Morris's peculiar actions. This led the newspaper that covered the story to say that it was obvious the case had not been investigated thoroughly enough and that more should be done. But even so, the authorities still weren't interested. They again urged the Sodders to move on with their lives. But George and Jeannie refused to give up. They sent letters to the FBI trying to get them involved with the investigation. The Bureau declined, saying they considered the matter related to appear to be of local character and doesn't come within the investigative jurisdiction of the Bureau. Now, the FBI did eventually investigate the case, though, as a possible kidnapping, but they found no new leads. In August 1949, the Sodders managed to convince Washington, D.C. pathologist Oscar B. Hunter to do a thorough search through the dirt and ashes left at the site. The local fire marshal protested. He said the place where the house had stood had been searched enough. There were no new clues to find. But the search went ahead anyway and added more confusion to the case. In the middle of the search, four spinal vertebrae bones were found. State authorities refused to examine them, so Detective Tansley sent them to the Smithsonian Institution, and experts there determined that the bones belonged to a male between the ages of 19 and 22. An age range that didn't match any of the missing children. Published reports stated that Tinsley later traced the bones to a cemetery in Mount Hope, West Virginia, but no explanation was available concerning their theft from an unidentified grave or how they managed to end up at the Sodder fire scene. Of course, that's just another of the lingering mysteries in this story. Despite the evidence that the vertebrae did not belong to any of the missing children, private investigator George Swain formally left the case. He issued a statement that he considered the case to be closed and his agency would not be, quote, taking part in pursuing the matter further. Well, the Sodders quickly replaced him with Troy C. Simmons of the West Virginia Merchant Police. He brought a new enthusiasm to the investigation, saying he believed the children were killed in a grudge murder, hinting at organized crime. You know, because the Sodders were Italian. Oh boy. He was sure they were dead and that the five missing children never left the county. He and his men planned to search abandoned wells and coal mines in the area and also added that he felt confident that arrests would be made in the next few days. But no arrests were ever made. While Simmons was searching coal mines in the region, the Sodders used the Smithsonian report to interest the FBI in their case. In 1950, the Bureau opened a file on the Sodder children as a possible interstate kidnapping. They pursued the case for 2 years, but with no results. Around that same time, the West Virginia State Police also looked into the case, but with the same amount of success, or I guess you'd say lack of it. The search led nowhere, but the family clung to hope. They ran newspaper ads and promised rewards, and then in 1952, they purchased a billboard near Anstead, West Virginia, that displayed photographs of the missing children with a $5,000 reward for information leading to their whereabouts. The text of the billboard read, "On Christmas Eve 1945, our home was set afire, and five of our children, ages 5 through 14, were kidnapped. The officials blamed defective wiring, although lights were still burning after the fire started. The official report stated that the children had died in the fire. However, no bones were found in the residue, and there was no smell of burning flesh during or after the fire. What was the motive of the law officers involved? What did they have to gain by making us suffer all these years of injustice? Why did they lie and force us to accept those lies?" The billboard was a visible manifestation of the lingering hope that the missing Sauter children would someday return home. Sadly, though, it generated no useful tips. It did, however, generate a lot of speculation. Rumors were constantly spread and included lurid stories of Italian fascists, mafia gunmen, and orphanages who snatched children and sold them to childless couples. George and Jeannie continued to be frustrated by the authorities, who still refused to open the investigation again. Years passed, but they didn't give up. They sent photographs of the five children to every possible resource, and this continued to start new rumors, create vague new stories, and bring in a lot of alleged sightings from all over the country. I mean, a woman in Charleston reported seeing all the children once and then Lewis by himself a year later, both times in the company of unknown adults. An anonymous letter writer claimed the children were living in Florida. The Sauters traveled there, but school records and birth certificates proved that none of the children in Florida were the missing children. Another letter claimed that Martha was living in a convent in St. Louis. Someone in Texas claimed to have overheard men talking about a fire that happened in West Virginia on Christmas Eve. A letter sent to a local sheriff in Santa Cruz County in California claimed the missing children were living in the town of Davenport. They weren't. Once, George saw a newspaper photo of young students at a New York Children's Aid Society ballet school and insisted that one of the girls in the photo was his daughter, Betty. He drove to Manhattan in search of the child, but her parents refused to let him see her. Unable to come up with a plan to get another look at her, he drove home disappointed. In 1966, a woman in Texas contacted the Sauters to say that she'd overheard a conversation between two men, one of whom identified himself as Maurice Sauter. George traveled to Texas. By the time he got there, though, the man was gone. The most promising lead in nearly two decades came in 1967, when Jeannie received an anonymous envelope through the mail. It was postmarked in Central City, Kentucky, and contained the photograph of a young man about the age her son Lewis would have been. Written on the back was a cryptic message. Lewis Sauter, I love brother Frankie, I-L-I-L boys, A-90132, or 35. While George and Jeannie were convinced the photo was an older-looking likeness of their missing son, they couldn't interpret the cryptic message on the back or trace the sender of the photograph. They rushed the photo and envelope to the West Virginia Attorney General's office, convinced this would reopen the investigation, but officials there were not convinced of the photo's authenticity. Frustrated but not defeated, they hired a new private detective to go to Central City and find out what he could. He took their money and was never heard from again. Heartbroken once more, George and Jeannie had the photograph enlarged and framed and placed it on their fireplace mantle with photographs of their other children. They were sure it was Lewis. They even had the new photograph added to the billboard with new text that read, "Picture number 6, received in 1967. Lewis, one and the same, now in another state." But was it really Lewis, or was it a mistake, or worse, a cruel hoax played on a family that was still grieving more than 20 years after their children disappeared? Well, that's the thing. The Sauters would never know. George Sauter died in 1969, still hoping for a break in the case. Jeannie put up a fence around their property, and she rarely left home. George's obituary stated he was survived by his wife and five remaining children. No mention was made of Maurice, Martha, Lewis, Jenny, or Betty. In 1984, Jeannie asked her son John to paint over the text on the billboard that promised a reward. She no longer had the money to pay it if someone should eventually claim it when the children returned home. She died 5 years later, still convinced her children were out there somewhere. The billboard in Anstett remained in place until her death, and then it was finally taken down. Today, the youngest surviving family member, Sylvia Sauter Paxton, keeps the family's haunting story alive with help from her daughter, still pursuing leads on the internet or wherever information might come from. Law enforcement officials still continue to refuse to reopen the case. They maintain that the Sauter home burned down in 1945 because of faulty wiring, killing the five children who were trapped inside. Case closed. After digging into this story for years, I'd have to say that whatever happened, that wasn't all there was to it. I admit I don't know what occurred that night, but I agree with just about everyone else who has heard the story of the Sauter children and think that this story is a lot more complicated than the authorities will ever be willing to admit. There's one thing that the American Hauntings podcast knows about, and that's mothers. We featured a lot of great mothers in a lot of our episodes. Pearl Curran, Julia Lemp, Sarah Moore, Marie Laveau, Jane Mansfield, Tamsin Donner, Delphine LaLaurie, Belle Gunness. Okay, maybe leave out those last two. But what I'm saying is that with Mother's Day coming soon, you need a truly special gift for your mom because, well, she's not Belle Gunness. So let me tell you about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that literally turns your mom's life story into a book. So here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send your mom a question in her email, the same way she sends you questions about your dating life or when you plan to give her grandkids. Anyway, these can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions that you want to ask. She replies by either typing in the answers or by recording her own voice. Then MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a keepsake book, and they can create an audiobook that uses her voice recordings, preserving her voice and her stories forever. As anyone who doesn't have their mom around anymore can tell you, having your mother's stories about growing up, being a kid, and overcoming life's challenges will be something that you and your kids will treasure. And let's be honest, your mom has given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a very cool way to share them. Honestly, I decided to try this out for myself and I sent it to my mom. And she's not exactly a whiz at computers, but she still found it really easy to use. My mom might have had a little more unusual childhood than a lot of mothers do. So I'm really glad to have this. And I think you'll be glad to give one to your mother too. So check out MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's MyLifeInABook.com and use the code HAUNTINGS for 10% off today.
Good to go?
Yep.
All right. Thanks for returning for more episodes of the American Hauntings podcast, where we discuss history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. This is season 7 of the podcast, which we call, and I don't even know if you're going to do this.
Home. Oh, shit. No, that's wrong. Wrong season. This one's gone.
Gone.
Sorry about that. Sorry.
Just forget
that I said that. Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. I'm your co-host, Cody Beck,
and
I have not heard anything about the next
season
yet, so
you haven't.
We are all on the same page as far as spoiler alerts. With me is my co-host, author, historian, crime buff, and the founder of American Hauntings, and apparently, what do you call somebody that spoils stuff?
I don't know. Spoiler?
Spoiler alert, Troy Taylor.
Yeah, I guess
what the hell?
Yeah, I don't know. I was just thinking about something else, I guess.
Troy, yes.
I know.
And
well, it's the last episode of the season.
It's the last.
And I got carried away.
I hope it's the last episode of the entire podcast, but it won't be because
everybody
loves us so much.
No, it is not.
It is not.
So Cody, he's trying really hard to shut this thing down, but I'm not going to let him. No, he's really not. But he's just a little under the weather. So I've got him here. And I'm trying to kind of. I'm trying to drag him through this episode.
I may be doing some
of the heavy lifting here rather than
heavy
asking. Well, that too. Having you ask me the questions, I may just be telling you the answers before you even get to the questions. But everybody will be fine. It's the last one of the season. So No, with that in mind, in case I don't get a chance until we come back for the next season, I should probably mention that we do have our winter events posted up on the dinnerandspirits.com website. You'll find the dinners and the winter tours that I've got coming up. Some of them, unfortunately, have sold out already, but we are...
Unfortunately?
Well, I mean, that's good for me, bad for people
bad who wanted
to attend ones in January, because they're starting to fill up. But, you know, hey, the Donner Party dinner is still open. So
I'm so hungry, where
you can be on the menu. But anyway, and I've got some new ones, too. And also, we got to mention Dead of Winter. Some of the after hour events have already sold out or are getting close. The VIP things with the reserved seating and t-shirts and all that stuff included.
Dead of Winter events that you are running that are still open?
Yes. Okay. Well, the VIP thing, we've got like two or four spots left for those. That's it. Those tickets. But the dinner on Friday night, the Ghosts and Gangsters dinner, kind of the theme with, you know, the St. Valentine's Day Massacre.
Oh, right.
That is two-thirds full. So it's still got some space. Unfortunately, the dinner tour I'm doing on Saturday night after things are over, that's sold out already. But we still do have the Sisterhood of Magic is now rebranded to the Appalachian Witches.
There you go.
I got all the two words confused there.
Yeah.
And we still have availability for the ghost hunt that night, too. But they're all filling up. So people, if you're planning on coming to Dead of Winter and you've been stocking up your canned goods and stuff, if you want to do any of these after hour things, you got to get on it, because the time is almost up for that.
Just bring us a can of green beans. Just throw it as far as you can, and we will accept you.
Yeah, we'll get it going.
We'll break two tables this year.
Yeah, well, we've got, you know, we have had more stuff than we've ever had before. Plus, we've got some guys in Springfield, the Springfield, Illinois Ghostbusters.
Tell me about this.
No, it's a guy, they do like cosplay Ghostbuster stuff. So they're going to be there. Yeah, and they're going to be picking up any canned goods for anybody who can't make it, who's in Springfield, Illinois. They can drop stuff off at Hy-Vee, and they're going to bring it down with them on the day of.
That is amazing. Are they going to have the backpacks and the whole
thing? They got the whole bit. They got the whole cosplay costumes.
Oh, my. That's amazing.
So, and they're talking about, they're hoping they can bring their Ghostbuster mobile. I don't think it's like a, you know, a classic ambulance or
the original,
but it's apparently decked out. So we'll see. But I know they're going to be there with all their
stuff. I hope they bring everything. That's amazing.
Yeah, I do too. It should be fun. So
that's the coolest thing in the world.
I just got that added up today. So anyway, keep an eye out for that stuff. And we've got some things coming, and we'll have another season coming. Later on, we'll make announcements on, you know, when the trailer is going to be released, details about the season, all that stuff will be coming soon. So just keep an eye on your feed, even if you don't see a lot of new stuff popping in there. Keep an eye on the feed anyway, because we do have stuff coming up.
So. Troy, we're kind of wrapping up, right? Like, I know time's a little weird, especially since of COVID, but everybody thinks that we only do things in October, which is not true.
Right.
But also, we kind of don't talk about necessarily when we record episodes, but so we're early December. Mm-hmm. And we're going to take a little bit of a break, but like, what's your plan for, like, how are things going to progress? Because I feel like it's time is kind of, what's the word, nebulous at this point, you know?
Yeah,
like,
well, usually the plan is to, we usually come back in mid to late January. So
yes,
it's about a month. And honestly, I'm off for about that amount of time too. I've got
You're not off.
Well, I've got an event this coming weekend, and then I won't have any more events. I know, but I won't have any more events until mid-January. So usually about that time, soon after, we usually come back with our next episodes, and or at least with the trailer. That, you know, like the trailer for this last season was like 40 minutes long. I know, but I don't think the trailer for this new season will be quite that long, but it won't be a 3-minute trailer of what's coming. It'll be an introduction to the season. So for sure.
Can I tell them right now too, like, it just, and we can cut this out if we have to, but I just want to tell people even right at this moment, I still don't know.
No,
what the next
because I told you what it was going to be. And then I changed my mind.
Yes.
As I often do. No. So, wait. But I will have, I am going to be working tomorrow on the detailed outline for the scene, which can change a little, but it's mostly there. I will have it to you soon.
I don't want to move my computer, but I wish I could show people that I have the physical outline for the last season hanging on one of my bookshelves right now. Because Troy, actually, the last, what, two seasons now?
You've printed you a booklet. Yeah.
Yes, you print me out like a nice booklet, and you usually present it to me. I love it so much. And then everybody gets to watch my reaction. Also, why we don't record that ever and put it on social media is on me. I guess it's more for me and you. But,
yeah, I guess.
But so I'm really excited to see what this next season's going to be.
Oh, I think you're going to like it. I think everybody's going to like it. In fact, I think our next one has the potential to be our best season yet.
Don't say that.
I really don't.
Don't get my hopes up.
I'm not joking. So I'm dead serious here. So I'm very excited about this next season and our next Patreon season two. I'm very excited about both of them.
You're playing like
gonna be cool.
5D chess. Okay.
I know. All right. Okay. So we have any listener reviews? Do you have any on your end? Because I've got texts. So
you know what, Troy? Normally I start with a listener review and then I go, and then you interrupt me. So how about let's go to the, what are we going to, the.
Okay, I think maybe we've got it.
I don't believe you.
I think our decision will be made by the time I'm done with these.
I don't believe you.
Yep. This is from our text line. Uh-huh. So if you have a comment about the show or a quick question you'd like to have answered on the show, you can either email Cody at the address he always mentions, which is
AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com.
There you go. Or you can text us at 217-791-7859. I'll repeat that back in a moment. But
I like that you actually highlighted that in red in outline too. I do appreciate that because that means that you are taking it seriously, and I do love that.
I do. I like it. I really enjoy it. I love to come in. And
I know you do.
That we've got new texts. So okay. So here's I got a few. So let me run through them. The first one is from Eliza in the 650. She says, "I love the both of you. You guys are great. I love the show, but I refuse to listen when it's dark. If I do, I get nightmares." Laughing face emoji. So this next one is from I'm not sure since she's going to talk about pronunciation in this, it's kind of funny that I'm not sure how to pronounce her name. It's either Rena or it's Renee because it's spelled R-E-N-A. So it could be either one. But anyway, I'm sorry. You did not offer me a pronunciation guideline. But
I mean, it is from
R-E-N-A in the 618. "Hi, Troy and Cody. I love the podcast. I love reading Troy's books because in my head, it's in Troy's voice. I also follow your Patreon and appreciate how many holes you poke into the exaggerated H.H. Holmes mythos. Most of all, as a Southern Illinoisan, I appreciate how you pronounce Mattoon correctly. I skip the podcasts that don't." By the way, I have to. I mean, I grew up like an hour from Mattoon. So know that one. I know that one.
I love it. I love it. I have so many comments. Keep going,
please. Yeah. By the way, I lived in a haunted old elementary school my parents bought and fixed up. And I lived in haunted Pemberton Hall at EIU in college. What? Just too many odd footsteps and doors closing in old buildings. I have family from Alton, Benton, and Heron, which all have spooky and tragic stories I've heard on your podcast and elsewhere, and I look forward to hearing more. I also second calling this number the haunt line. All right, now, Karen for the 360 and Matt for the 618, both of them sent us their Spotify Wrapped for 2023 with American Hauntings as their number one show.
Oh my gosh.
And Matt was the guy who suggested the haunt line for this number in the first place because Cody wanted it to be a pun. So he's going to get credit for that if we use it. And honestly, I think maybe that's the way to go.
So, okay.
I'm really starting to lean toward the haunt line. I really am. I like that. I like it a lot.
I have so many thoughts. Okay.
All right. So then I've got one from Kirk from the 336. He says, "Hey, Troy and Cody, love the podcast. I've been a fan of Troy's book since I moved to Illinois in 2010. I recently moved to DeKalb, which is I'm going to then pronounce that for you for the 10th time because you can't, for whatever reason, pronounce that name right. We've done it every time we talk about it. No, it isn't. No, it isn't. Anyway, I was interested in learning more obscure local history from the area. I was wondering if you had any recommendations of good resources to use. And then he took my recommendations and just dumped them. Aside, this is his thing, aside from the local library and the historical society's collections. Well, dude, that's where I was going to send you first. My other suggestion would be, as I always like to recommend, newspapers.com, because they have such an archive of stuff that's available now that you can see on your own computer.
You would fucking know. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And if let's say your local papers aren't on there, the library will have them. Or the local newspaper will. So a lot of times they offer a search service, but you got to know what you're looking for. So that's kind of a problem. My suggestion would be to try newspapers.com, but definitely don't rule out the local library and the historical society, because that's going to be a good source for stuff, depending on who works there, who the volunteers are. That makes a difference. So anyway, all right. So this one is from Deb in the 912. She said, I enjoy you all so much. I drove around Alton one morning last June as I was driving through a beautiful town. Aww. I just listened. We won't take credit for that.
That's a lie.
But, yeah. But I just listened to the story about Jody. I wonder if the State Bureau of Investigation got involved since law enforcement officials were implicated. Well, the answer to that is yes and no, not really. Yes, they did get involved because everybody was involved in that case at one time or another, but they didn't get involved because of law enforcement officials, because none of that was ever really followed up on, because that that claim was said to be somewhat suspicious as kind of a revenge thing, because she had been suing the department at the time, and then the suit had been dismissed. She'd been fired. And then so it's thought that that was just kind of retaliation. But the idea also got picked up, though, by locals, because any chance that people have to hate the cops, they'll take it. And so a lot of people have kind of kept that alive. But I really don't think there's any truth to it. Some of the stuff they claimed even got, you know, proven to be not true. Like the guy that they said it was, you know, body was buried under his machine shed, and he didn't even live there when Jody disappeared.
Right.
Anyway, so she has a little bit more here. Hypothetically, Swanson, and she's talking about Brandon Swanson, the kid from the other episode, may have been dropping off someone who could have caused a controversy in a small community. A classmate, a teacher, an adulterous or underage relationship, and if discovered, could wreak havoc in his life, which kind of, that makes sense. That's a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
He may have been flustered on the phone with his parents, thinking that his secret was going to be discovered. She said, but I do agree with you. The river probably was his demise. In the same episode, we also talked about Sharon Pretorius, too, and she had a comment about that. She said, I wonder if her older brother was a suspect. All the awful possibilities. You know, the mom would logically protect her son to prevent him from going to prison if he'd done anything. So, you know, with the idea of why lose another child? It's a thought. I don't know that anything ever was pursued by that. Whether or not he had an alibi, I don't know. I never saw anything about that being questioned about her brother, but that doesn't mean that it didn't happen. I'll probably be digging a little bit more into that story when I'm working on the second Without a Trace book, so which I'll be working on that very soon. So
can I ask a question here real quick?
Yeah, of course.
So I'm thinking now, how much of, so you obviously have a bajillion books going on all the time, and you have like sequels and everything like that. But how often does it happen that we get a listener review or comment or question that actually makes you then be so intrigued to go back
and
research more?
Well, this season. It's been like that. Yeah. All the comments and things that we've gotten from people, not even just about some of the episodes, but about new stories that we didn't cover, you know, because I ask everybody, hey, if you've got something we didn't cover, let us know. And people have. I mean, I've gotten a lot of stuff. I've got stuff directly emailed to me. Mm-hmm. I've had messages sent to me on Twitter. I've had stuff sent to me on the haunt line or whatever we're going to call it. If it's the haunt line, the text line.
I like the haunt line.
Yeah, I do too. So I've had a lot of interesting stuff and a lot of good ideas. And it's I had no intention of doing a sequel to that book. That was not even on my radar. So I can't even say I moved a book from the back burner to the front burner because it wasn't even on the back burner. I didn't even have the ingredients for the recipe at that point, but now I do. And now I've been putting it together. So it's going to be a fun one to do a sequel to.
That's interesting. Cause I mean, a lot of the reason I wanted to start this podcast in the first place was I wanted to learn more, but I also wanted to help kind of, push some of your products, but like get people out there that were interested in these sort of things. And so it's really interesting to me to see when you then get excited about.
Like, yeah. Well, I think we've built a community of a lot of really nice people.
Yeah.
And who've gotten interested in the show and gotten interested in what we're doing. And I think that, it just kind of becomes a collaborative effort sometimes with some of this stuff. So it's been really interesting. And, I'm looking forward to seeing, where it goes. So anyway,
I want to jump
into this episode and get this rolling while you're still sitting upright.
I do. And so, as Troy kind of mentioned earlier, this is going to be a little bit different. Basically my notes are, Jeannie Sauter.
Yeah, Jeannie.
Woken from her sleep. That's as
and
far
that's
as,
it.
Yeah. That's as far that's as what, I have gone.
That's what I wondered. So
Troy, can you walk me through this? I read about someone talking to her on the phone, a woman's voice, and I'm like, I was like, am I dreaming? Is this what the?
Yeah.
Here's
the thing. You can, when you're finished with this episode, you can still say, what the hell is going on? Because there is nothing about this. It is one of those. Because to be completely honest with you, there's no guarantee this is even a missing persons case. Because officially, it is not. But
how do you not know if somebody's missing?
Well, we'll get to that. So,
okay.
All right. So this is our, as I stressed with the gloomy Christmas music, this is our holiday episode. Yes. I always try to do something, holiday-ish at the end of the season as we get kind of close. Yeah. Yeah. And, this was kind of it because it takes place, on Christmas morning. Our Christmas Eve into Christmas morning. And it involves the Sauter family who lived in West Virginia, this Italian family, a big group, big fake family, Catholics, of course, 1940s.
Oh, look at my nose. I know.
What I'm saying. So you got a lot of kids here. And, but Jeannie is asleep. Her husband runs his own business. They're doing pretty well, pretty good at business running. He's got an office in the house, and that's their only telephone. Again, not uncommon for that time. Mm-hmm. Also not uncommon that it's a party line. So you had a bunch of people who I didn't know if anybody even knew what a party line was.
I mean,
it was something that happened in rural communities a lot back in the day.
Can you explain to me though, like, could you seriously just pick up the phone and be
listen to other people's conversation? Absolutely. Yeah.
So that's really how it
works. Yeah. There might be like five families using the same line. And like if you had an emergency, you might call up and go, hey, I got to call an ambulance. And then those people would hang up and you would get the operator to put you through. That's exactly how it worked. Yeah. It was not exactly great for privacy, as you might imagine.
So were phone calls just not that prominent?
I think they became more prominent, but it wasn't like everybody didn't feel like they had to have one at the time. I mean, it's 1945 here, and not everybody felt they needed a phone, and in rural communities they just couldn't string enough lines for everybody.
You've been alive for 20 years at that point. And so,
yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah. We just didn't always have phones in 1945. And, when you lived out in the country, like I did, we had party lines and that's the way it worked.
Troy, I have to ask them, like, and I know we're obviously being facetious and making jokes and stuff, but like, how long do you think during the day, unless you're working, maybe, how long do you think it is in between you at least acknowledging your phone? Because I'll tell you right now, for me, it's 15 minutes at the most.
It depends. I mean, it's usually on my desk because if I'm doing something I don't have to concentrate on, I'm probably listening to a podcast.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So if somebody texts
not
me,
ours.
Not ours, no.
No, a good one.
But If I hear, you know, a text come in or something, I might see who it is. But I may not get back to it right away. It just depends on who it is that's texting. Like if it's you, I go, God. And then I just don't even bother, you know.
Yeah,
I'll get back to it in a day or so, whatever, you know. But it just depends. So I think things were just different back then, you know.
Of course.
Phone calls weren't really essential. I mean, they didn't have one for their home. It was the office was in the house, but the office or the phone was in the office. So when Jeannie woke up because the phone was ringing, it was coming from the office. And she went down and answered it because, you know, if it had been an emergency of some kind, because remember, they'd had a kid that was in the military, you know, not all the kids lived at home.
Yeah.
So if it had been an emergency, she would have wanted to answer it. And who else calls at that time of night except an emergency?
Uh-huh.
Except she gets, you know, a wrong number call. She gets a dead open call of people laughing, what sounds like a party going on. And it's odd. It's just odd. And honestly, if none of the rest of these things would have happened after that, I'm sure she would have never even remembered this. You know what I mean? This is such an innocuous thing. But then she woke up later because she thought she heard something thumping on the roof. And then the next thing you know, the house is on fire. So, I mean, I'm not going to walk through this entire thing, step of the way, but, you know, this fire broke out, and, you know, it burned the house down. They managed to get, most of the kids got out of the house. You know, the ones who, you know, had been there, were all upstairs. They got a couple of the kids out of the house. The little ones, you know, the little one was out. I mean, the ones that were right there, they got out of the house. The other ones that were upstairs, even though, you know, one of the brothers got out, but yet some of the kids didn't.
Yeah.
They just disappeared. Five of them were still in the house. Well, the house caught on fire. What I wanted to, and I do mention it, but when I think about this fire, I always picture in my mind them standing outside watching the house burn and seeing the Christmas tree with its lights still on in the window.
Oh my gosh.
And watching all the lights in the house going out one at a time. And then just that Christmas tree still on. And then it goes out too. And so, that, I mean, I think that you could make a movie out of this.
They have made movies out of that.
I mean, this particular story is so weird that, you know, it's so bizarre. I mean, the whole thing is so weird. I mean, it's weird. The firemen come. Well, first, there's this comedy of errors, or it would have been a comedy, more of a tragedy of errors. But, you know, they can't get to the window because the ladder's gone.
Uh-huh.
The trucks don't start, even though they were fine the day before on Christmas Eve. Trucks ran fine. Won't start Christmas morning. Not that cold. No logical reason why. Telephone wire's been cut. So they can't. Didn't matter anyways. They can't get the house to call anybody. They try to go call someone. They can't. Finally, somebody runs to a local tavern to use a phone, calls the fire department, has to, you know, wake up the fire chief, who can't drive the truck.
I've seen this movie.
He can't drive the truck. So he's trying to find somebody who can. Nobody's answering their phones because all the operators are not on duty because it's Christmas.
So
when they finally do get a hold of somebody, by then the fire's out. By the time the firefighters get there, it's just smoldering ruins. And then they stand there and go, "Nah, looks like an electrical fire to me," and left. That's pretty much it.
You're not on a tangent. You're excited. But can I pause and rewind it a little bit? So, okay. How do phones work back then? And you're talking.
What do you mean? How do phones work? Same way they work now. You dial a number. Well, no, not then. You had to get an operator, and they had to connect you.
I'm thinking I have four alarms set, and sometimes they don't wake me up. So I'm thinking back then I have to get up. I grab a rotary phone, and then I have to go to the operator.
So have you ever seen
the order of operations?
All right. So have you ever seen the Andy Griffith Show?
Of course. Yes,
okay.
Absolutely.
So you know how when they pick up the phone and they say, "Hey, Sarah, can you connect me to the courthouse?"
Yes.
That's how phones worked.
Okay. So there's an emergency. How long does it take to get to someone that can actually help when you're, because right now I can be like 911, help me. How long does it take back?
Okay, so, well, if there usually was an operator on duty. but not in small rural communities on Christmas. I mean, that wasn't any conspiracy with the operators.
Sure.
Some of the rest of this stuff, who the hell knows? But the operator was not. That's just how it was. They didn't think anybody was going to need a call. Nobody thought about emergencies. 1945, we're still at the end of, we just finished a goddamn war to end all wars.
WW2,
so yeah. Nothing's going to seem that bad at this point. There aren't any emergencies worse than Pearl Harbor being bombed or whatever, right? So they just figured that they don't need to worry about it. It's Christmas. People need a night off. And so nobody was working in the middle of the night on Christmas. And normally, I'm sure that there was a good reason for that. Normally, there probably weren't any calls. This time, there was. They picked up the line. They tried to call out. They could not call out because there were no operators to connect them to anybody. Now, if you lived in a larger city, you could dial direct. Phones did have a rotary dial on them. But where they lived, you had to have an operator connect you.
Okay, you usually
would dial zero unless the operator was on the line when you picked it up. In this case, they normally were, but not this night.
So they couldn't
get anybody. So then the police chief, or fire chief rather, has to wait and start calling when operators come on duty. And because there's no fire alarm in town, it's a volunteer fire department, which means there were no paid guys except for him. So there's not guys sitting around a firehouse somewhere off duty or on duty. He has to call all of these guys individually, and they had what was called a phone tree. One guy would call one guy, then another guy would call two guys, another guy would call two more guys. The problem was that nobody can answer the phones. And then when they finally do, and they finally get out to the scene, by then hours and hours have gone by, and the place is a smoldering ruin. They go in looking to see if they can pull out the bodies of those five kids that are still inside, and they claim they can't find any bodies because the fire was so hot that it burned and cremated the bodies. As I discussed in the episode, that's completely impossible.
Jet fuel can't melt steel beams.
The fire never burned hot enough. There was still like appliances that were okay in the basement. There's no way that the fire was hot enough to destroy those bodies. And that's where all of this stuff comes from. Plus, you've got a state trooper who writes a report in the coroner's jury, uses that same report that said that the fire was caused by faulty wiring. Now, he never checked for this. He was not an electrician. He didn't have anybody come in and examine it. The house was brand new. They had just built the house. The wiring was brand new. So that seems kind of hard to believe. In addition to the fact that, the fire, the cremation would have taken, 1800 degrees. And yet, you got a blender downstairs that's not melted. So that's impossible. Why George decided that, I kind of get it. The guy's grieving. People do weird things when they grieve. But when he gets a bulldozer and just demolishes the house and fills the basement full of dirt, I thought that was a weird move.
The lady don't protest too much.
It was just weird. And I don't, based on everything else that happens, I don't see any ulterior motive here for him to have done that, other than he was just acting a little crazy when, he was grieving the loss of five children. So I kind of get that. But aside from that, I don't know. I don't find anything else weird on their part. Sad, a lot of sad on the part of George and Jeannie. But, but then when they start looking back at some of the things that have happened, like the guy who shows up and asks for work and George says he doesn't have anything. And the guy looks at his fuse box and says, ooh, that's going to cause a fire someday.
Yeah.
I mean, that's kind of like what I always say is, the kind of insurance where you go in someplace and you go, boy, sure got a nice place here. Sure be bad if something happened to it. It's like that kind of thing. And then you got the insurance guy who shows up and wants to sell him a policy, and he passes, says no thanks. Guy gets mad and says he's gonna, something's gonna happen to him. His house is gonna burn down and his kids are gonna die because George has been saying bad things about Benito Mussolini. Really? I mean, that's just bizarre. I mean, who's a fan of Mussolini?
But what do you, okay, what do you think? I mean, I know there's no way to really, really tell, but you got kind of two different options going on here. Like, either everything's a coincidence and life just happens, or
yeah,
there's something else going on.
I don't know, man. It's hard to say because they never got anywhere with it. Not really. Yeah. I mean, and they had a lot of people working on it. Eventually, yeah. Even the FBI. They had those private detectives. Only one of them screwed them over. But a couple of those guys were working off the clock on their own free time. They got so obsessed
and
with
this story. They're smart people.
And they were busting their ass. And they're traveling all over the country. They're running down every story. And you know how that is. We've done that all season. Uh-huh. Talked about, you know, people with these fake stories about, oh, we saw him here, saw him there, you know, and they would go everywhere and run this stuff down. But, you know, none of it was adding up to anything, you know. So, I mean, they're throwing out this stuff about the insurance salesman and the people who show up at the house and tell Jeannie they want to see the babies and the, you know, the guy who comes to the house and says, you know, that he broke in and stole that block and tackle out of the garage, coincidentally on the same night of the fire, and said that he cut the telephone line, but there's no way he could have because of the way the line was cut. Yeah. So, I mean, all of this stuff is just bizarre, it doesn't make any sense.
Something I've been thinking about, Troy, is like for as long as you and I have been doing this, like I could just get online pretty quick and Google stuff and look at things. You had to kind of like go through like microfiche and all that sort of stuff. When I first started it. But even before that, imagine chasing down leads, working your ass off to go nowhere just to be like, okay, now I can rule that out. That would wear me out.
Yeah.
If I Google stuff for too long and I can't find anything.
Oh yeah. Even that irritates me. I know.
I'm done.
Yeah. We've gotten lazy. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Based on stories like this of detectives who are traveling all over the country or just George Sauter.
Yeah.
Who's driving all over the country, you know, and shows up, sees, before I even get to that.
Okay.
I have to say something other than in the podcast about the buried liver.
Okay, we'll take a step back. Okay.
What the hell? The fire chief who goes out to the site and buries the box that he claims is a heart of one of the children, and he found it in the fire, unburned.
Yeah.
I mean, that makes absolutely no sense.
It's some Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, and then they dig it up, and it's not a heart; it's a goddamn liver. And then they take it to the funeral home, and one of the detectives shows up to see it, and the guy's like, "Oh yeah, I left it out on the back porch." What?
Yeah,
I mean, what in the hell is going on here?
I feel like at some point
it's such a bizarre story,
especially if you are a or if you're a law enforcement person. I feel like at some point you just pull out your gun and be like, "Okay, you know what? We're gonna sit down. We're gonna
yeah, right. Like, yeah,
it's like
can't
that's
do that.
That's not that like or hit him with a phone book. Like you know yeah, that's yeah. that's not okay. But I think about like, gosh, how quickly it's escalated so much between driving 100 miles, you doing your research the way you have done it, or at least in the 90s when I was a child,
me doing
my stuff now. And I'm like, I get so bored and so frustrated so quickly. Imagine driving 100 miles and then like,
driving from West Virginia to New York because you saw a picture of a girl at a ballet school you thought was one of your daughters.
Oh yeah.
Now, see, so that's at the point though. That's where it goes beyond I'm doing detective research and off the rails.
I feel
bad for them. And I get it. I totally understand where it's coming from.
Because you're a father. Well, it's a
sympathetic thing. You know, it's not me looking at them and going, yeah, you guys are nuts. It's not that. It's just, this is where it just stopped being bizarre and then just became sad.
But
before it even got to that part, though, there were so many weird things, you know, like them going back and digging up the site and now finding bones that matched, you know, kids that, you know, were aged 19 to 22, which didn't match any of the kids. And then finding out the bones were dug up out of a local cemetery and planted there.
why, where, who, what? Well,
that's also not kids. I mean, that's a
that's young adults. I know, right, but that's right, bizarre too.
That's what I mean. So
yeah, well, that's kind of where the point where they got where they were saying, you know, okay, so this is someone, you know, they're digging up bodies from, or bones from cemeteries and planting them at the site. This goes beyond just odd at this point. This is, if it's not evil, it's somebody really trying to cover
malicious.
But here's the thing. Okay. Uh-huh. So there's all this. Okay. There's the billboard.
Yes.
You know, they put the billboard up that says, you know, hey, our kids ages 5 through 14 were kidnapped. You know, officials aren't doing anything. They're saying they died in the fire, but there's no bones. You know, here's a reward. Please help us. Why did they lie to us? Okay. That's one thing. But then it goes beyond that, and it starts to become sad, as I already mentioned.
That was despair.
But
yeah.
Okay, but my question is though, and this is why when you said this to me and when we first started talking about this, and I said, well, officially this isn't a missing persons case officially, because you know, according to law enforcement, the authorities, this was closed. These right. kids died in the fire, period. That's the end of the story as far as they're concerned. They never reopened it. They refused to reopen it. No matter what kind of information came in, they never reopened it. And, you know, maybe all these things were a coincidence. I mean, maybe none of those things really add up to anything. Maybe it's just a lot of weird stuff. Because here's my question, okay? Mm-hmm. So this is my big question with the story.
Yeah.
Why? Why? To what why? Purpose, give me yeah. any explanation as to why, and this is not just to you, this is to this listener.
Good, yeah.
If you've got an explanation for me as to why someone would have come in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve, Christmas morning, and stole just 5 of the kids, not all of them, just 5, leaving some there still sleeping, who never heard a thing, who passed by a daughter sleeping on the couch to get into the house in the first place, why would they have gone upstairs, somehow taken 5 of these kids for what legitimate reason? I have no idea.
Right.
And then kidnap them and then went to all the trouble to cover things up and make it look like they died in a fire. Why? I mean, there's lots of things you can say. Oh, you know, child, you know, sex trafficking, even though it's 1945, whole different thing then, but still same, been around forever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you could say those things, but it still doesn't fit. Why just some of those kids? Why not the rest? How did they get in the house in the first place? Yeah. Why were they never found? I mean, yes, there were all these reports, but we don't know if any of them were verified. None of them were verified, so we don't know if any of them were even accurate. They may have been just like this loony shit we've talked about all season, about crazy people coming forward with stories. What is the purpose of a kidnapping?
I think that, and this is me saying this, not being a father, having, you know, a bunch of brothers and sisters and all that
sure.
sort of stuff, but not being a father. But I think I would never stop looking for that
well,
answer.
Well, no, I get
and
that.
I would let it I would let it destroy.
Yeah,
me.
No. And I get that. And I completely understand that. They even if those kids did die in that fire and they didn't think it was possible, even if they really did, I completely understand their reaction. They didn't want to accept it. And there was enough evidence
That's
to suggest that maybe they didn't die in the fire. But again, though, that's not my question. My question is
why
would someone have taken just those kids?
Well, I think I get to flip this onto you, which you always do to me, which is it is pretty much like you're trying to reach a conclusion that was reached illogically.
Okay, so you want I'm trying to find logic in criminal behavior.
Yeah.
In an illogical situation where there no logic exists.
I think that this is maybe the first time
I mean that's fair.
I've ever got to flip this onto you because
that's fair.
But yeah, because yeah, I mean
while I find this a fascinating story, that's always been the thing that has bothered me about it.
Of course.
I can't
come up with
any logical reason why this would have happened. I just don't understand it. I just don't.
What is it? I hate this so much, but it's some men just want to watch the world burn.
Oh, you know? I know. Like, you know. I know
that kind of bullshit.
There, I know. And yeah, but we could use that excuse for anything. But I think of there's course. Logic behind more things than there isn't.
So,
this story just makes no sense to me.
So just does it frustrate you that you can't find any kind of logic into the reasonable solution?
It does. It's why this story bothers me so much. Yeah. I mean, I've been fascinated with it for probably 20 years. I've written about it before.
I've dug into it and redug into it.
And I have never come up with any better conclusions than what I have is that I don't know what occurred that night. Well, I think this story is more complicated than the authorities were willing to admit, but I still can't find any logic behind why anyone would have taken these kids. No, there isn't. There really isn't. You know, I get it. I understand it. I understand what the family was thinking. I do. Right. I just don't understand why anyone would have done it. That's all.
That's my favorite part about the podcast is you and I get to talk about these things that don't make sense, that should make sense, but that we never, ever, ever really know.
I guess. And but, you know,
I
am more willing to talk about something paranormal because I know there is no real answer than to something like this where there should be an answer and there isn't. So I don't know.
Isn't that kind of like the like what my mom would say, where like chalk it up to faith sort of thing? You're like, okay, that's like a cop out.
No, that is a cop out. Well, so is what you said to me.
Well, sometimes there's
no logic. Sometimes some men just want to watch the world burn. That's the same as chalk it up to faith.
But I thought
there is what, no.
You were saying is
no. Fuck no. I want a goddamn answer. I'd rather have something that is there's no way to answer. It's impossible to answer. So I just go to hell with it. There's no way to answer this question. So forget it. There should be an answer to this question. This is nothing to do with the supernatural.
No, that's the thing. What I was saying is I think that you sometimes would be like, let's chalk it up to faith, meaning paranormal. And that's why this one pisses you off because.
Yeah, but I don't usually say that though. How often do I say that? I don't.
But
in the back of my mind, I would rather say, okay, there's not going to be an answer for this. I'll have to wait till I die to find out. I will never find out who Jack the Ripper was.
Or Black Dahlia. And
who killed the Black Dahlia. Yeah, I'm never going to know those things. Not while I'm alive.
Is this number three for you?
No, it's not that high on the list, but it is on my list though. I want to know what the hell happened in the story because it makes no sense to me. You know, it makes sense. It doesn't make sense. They couldn't have died in the fire. They couldn't have because it wasn't hot enough. So, and there were no bodies. Right. So they didn't die in the fire. I'm willing to accept that.
Okay.
I'm willing to accept that as weird as all that other stuff is, I can ignore all that and say that I'm willing to admit that they somehow got out of the fire and did not die in it. But why?
And that's where
it loses me. Why? There is no why. I have no why. No one has a why.
I want to dig into this just for like maybe 30 more seconds.
Everyone has already turned this off. You know that, right?
Yeah, I don't
listening to us yell at each other.
We made a podcast for each other. I rarely ever see you get so fired up about stuff though like this.
This one bothers me.
I know
it annoys me. It's why I saved it for last.
So
and it's Christmassy.
Well, yes, but okay. We talk about the Lawson family or whatever. Like the
oh, I get that one. Dude was nut.
Yeah,
that was crazy.
I get
that one. It's horrible, but I get it.
That one made me fucking cry.
I understand. It's a Marion Parker story. I get it. People are crazy. That I can understand.
Why
this? Okay. I don't.
You didn't get as fired up over that one though.
No, because I had no open questions.
There's a resolution
about either. Yeah, I didn't have a question. Like, you know, I knew what happened to Marion Parker. I knew the dude paid the price. I knew Charlie Lawson killed his whole family. Guy was crazy. I get it. I'm glad he shot himself. I wish somebody else would have shot him.
Yeah.
I don't know. I wish his kid would have shot him, honestly. But that's the way it goes. I don't have any questions about those stories. It's the stories like this that I do have questions about that really bother me. I think that this Vanish Without a Trace stuff makes me insane. I think that's why I enjoy working on it so much. So, you know, I just do. I mean, it's unsolvable in most cases. Not every one of them. Some of them, I think there are answers. I just don't get.
Well, okay.
I just don't get it.
So, podcast listeners, should I continue to help Troy and keep going with these things that he enjoys, but he can't understand? But at what point to his mental health? I don't know what to do now because I've seen you kind of.
I'm fine. I just about it. I like talking about it. It's like I like complaining about things. It's fun. You know, it's just fun. It brings me joy. I don't know why. It just does. When I get to complain about a movie or complain about a restaurant, I mean, I don't go and, you know, make reviews and stuff. I'll just tell my friends. I'll just, you know, bitch about something.
Yeah, you don't have a letterbox full.
No. In fact, I mean, I've got, I do not. I don't even have a letterbox where I bitch too much about movies. No. I know all the work that goes into making.
Exactly.
I know that someone poured their heart and soul into it. Yes, I gave it a 1-star review. And yes, I said it was terrible, but I also know that somebody really thought it was a great idea. So I try to leave that stuff alone. I just don't rate it high. I just don't say much about it.
I bet you probably either do.
But I might tell you
exactly
personally what garbage it is, you know. So
I bet you either do no review, 1 or 5, because people that give 4-star reviews and they're like,
I didn't.
It's like, shut the fuck up.
No, I always do 4-star reviews, but only, and I told you why. Sometimes it's 4.5, but I don't think anything is perfect.
Of course.
I mean, I may have loved it, absolutely loved it, but you know.
It's the same thing. Like,
but I can't find anything wrong with it. I love this movie. It's great. I'm going to watch it 100 times before my life is over, but nothing's perfect.
And it's a similar thing. Like, I think like Charlie, you and I could like, say we go through like Taco Bell or whatever, like we'll go Yelp. Right. And it's like,
yeah, I would never do that. Okay. I hate Yelp.
Okay. So. Well, yes, but that's the Yelp like effect is you go through. Everything is absolutely perfect, but you know, you order no lettuce, no tomatoes on this, whatever you have a company order.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will be like 4-star reviews because the person handing it to me didn't smile. And people like you and I are
brother.
Are you fucking kidding me? No, nothing was wrong with this. And
right.
I think if you haven't been in that position to be on the other side of it, I think a lot of people are like,
sure,
or you haven't put your blood, sweat, and tears into a movie.
Yeah.
It's kind of like people are just looking for things to be upset about or
mad
about.
Yeah, and that's a Yelp thing. It is.
And it is. But I feel like that's kind of what it's almost like. I feel like what you're doing right now, and not to say we're not.
Oh, no. I get it.
I know. It's just there's never going to be anything that will satisfy you. But it's interesting to me because I never see you this worked up.
Well, this is just it's just so baffling. I want to. I'm like Fox Mulder.
I wanted to believe, except that wasn't
right because he always believed.
Of course he did.
99% of the time.
Samantha.
But I know. But so I want this to be this mysterious conspiracy laden story.
Yeah.
I really do. But I can't logically come up with a reason why it would be. That's all. It just bugs me. It bugs me. You know, I want these things to have been real for these people's sake. I want them to have had this conspiracy to build their life around
because that
was how they, you know, managed to survive this tragedy.
Of course.
But it makes no sense. It just makes no sense. Why would anyone kidnap those kids? I just don't get it. That's all. That's all I'm saying. And we've gone on way too long.
Yeah, I don't want to beat this.
We got to wrap this up. No, we got to wrap it up. This is our last episode. We got to wrap it up. Yeah, we gave them their money's worth. We talked a lot, but we got to wrap this thing.
Oh gosh. So, think about how many Patreon people have canceled now.
Oh, I know. Like, I can't deal with this. These guys. Yeah. So anyway,
let's wrap this up.
We just want to say thank you again for listening to this entire season. Hopefully you're still here at the end of this episode.
It's just me.
I apologize for getting completely out of control on this one.
Apologize.
It just really bugs me. But thank you so much for sticking with us. Thanks for enjoying the season with us. At least we hope you did. I did a lot. In fact, I'm searching for ways to keep it going. Thanks to you. I can. So I'm going to turn it into another volume of a book, at least one, God knows there may be more than that before we're done with this thing. But, Anyway, if you are, if you're, you know, wanting to stick with us for another season, we do have another one coming. Just give us a little time to get things together, take a break from the holidays, enjoy the holidays, and we will be back with season number 8 coming up soon. In the meantime, it is 8, right?
Yeah. Really?
Yeah, it'll be 8. So
8 seasons?
Yep. If you are, if you just can't stand the fact that you're going to have to wait a little while for the next one, we do have now almost, we're almost there for 3 full seasons of our other podcast, Dead Men Do Tell Tales, that we do on Patreon. We are down to the very end of that season as well. That means that you'll have brand new shows to listen to if you haven't signed up yet. You could become a supporter at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings and listen to some more shows before we start back up. And then we'll be back for a new season in 2024. So come see us at Dead of Winter. We'll already be rolling with the new season by then, but we'll cook something up that goes along with our theme or our winter theme and have something a little bit different, as we always do when we do our live episode at Dead of Winter. And so anyway, I think that because I got to run this episode, I am going to close it out. And I've never done this before. So here we go. This episode, yeah, I know, right? This episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by Cody Beck.
Yeah.
If you enjoyed the show, leave us a review on iTunes. Tell your friends, neighbors, and random people on the street about it. And follow us on iTunes, Spotify, or anywhere you listen to your favorite podcasts. See the website at AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com for more info about the show, notes, photos, links, and more.
Yeah, it's a little
awkward. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok, and anywhere else you waste hours every day.
We're still doing TikTok?
When you're supposed to be, well, not very much, supposed to be working or studying. And it's not even called Twitter anymore. And I'm just ignoring that because to me, it will always be Twitter.
Right.
Anyway, we promise we're much more entertaining.
What?
Well, we are than Twitter. I can tell you that. Anyway, thanks for listening. We couldn't and we definitely wouldn't do it without you. Yeah. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
And see you later.
First off, thank you so much for all the help.
Yeah.
Sure. That was really fun.
That was fun.